This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
All right, yes, hello, hello, hello. Welcome along. It's a brand new episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. This is the show where we take a trip to the most amazing, weird and wonderful places in the universe, and we try and get you back home within the hour. Now, my name is Dan. Hello. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. Today, well, speaking of space, really, we'll hear about a planet that is 20 light years away from Earth. And it's very special because scientists think that it's the most likely one out there that could support life. We might go and live there one day, if you don't mind getting your face melted off in the process. Also, we'll talk about a brand new ape, and we'll hear from an animal expert about why you're more like a rat than you think you are. It's kind of gross, but it's fascinating. It's on the way after we catch up with one of Fun Kids' favourite geniuses, Sir Sidney McSprocket, our inventor, who's here to tell us how some of the things that you use every day were made.
How's it made?
Oh, hello. Sir Sidney McSprocket here. I've been in action capturing facts all about manufacturing. It's for this rather splendid stipendiary compendium I'm compiling. You just ask it how something is made, and it'll oblige with a fulsome explanation. Take this, for example, a plastic bottle, a common enough item, and one with which you'll be well acquainted. But how is a plastic bottle made? Many plastic bottles are made of a substance called PET. That's short for polyethylene terephthalate. It makes bottles that are lightweight and strong, useful when bottles are used for food and drinks.
Step one.
Pellets of PET and recycled plastics are loaded into special ovens and heated to 260 degrees centigrade so that it melts. This melted plastic is then injected into small molds. That's like a hollow space that shapes the plastic into long, thin tubes.
Step two.
The tubes are reheated and placed in bottle-shaped molds where high-pressured air inflates them to fill the mold and to take their final shape.
Step three.
Sometimes, to make sure that the bottom of each bottle has a flat shape to help it stand up straight, another piece of plastic is joined to the bottle during the molding process.
Step four.
The bottles must be cooled instantly, or they will lose their shape as the warm plastic will creep downwards. Sometimes cold water or liquid nitrogen might be circulated around the molds, or air is blown at room temperature.
Step five.
Like most manufacturing, it's important to test samples from the production line. Samples will be measured to make sure they're the right shape and size. They'll also be squashed to see how strong they are. Once ready, the finished bottles will be boxed up, ready for dispatch.
Step six.
The final step is putting a cap onto the bottle. This is done by the food company after the drink or food has been added. Whilst plastic is a very versatile material, it can take hundreds of years to decompose naturally. That's why it's really important to recycle any that you use. Now, I must get on, but come back soon and find out more about manufacturing with my splendid stipendiary compendium.
How's it made? With support from the Royal Commission for the 1851 exhibition. Find out more at funkidslive.com.
There are loads more episodes from Sir Sidney McSprocket where you can find out how things that you use every single day are made. And you can download them all right now. Get to the free Fun Kids app and you can have a listen at funkidslive.com. I got a question that's been sent over to my page at funkidslive.com from Henry. And Henry asks two things. Why is air invisible? And why can you see your breath in winter? Henry, it's a great question. It's kind of mind-blowing, really. And there's two things with it. You can see your breath in winter because it's hotter than the air that is floating all around you. So it turns that air to condensation, to water vapour. You know, like the kind of stuff that you see dripping down the window on a boiling hot day outside? So that's that sorted. Now, as to why air is invisible, I don't really know, if I'm honest. I think that's a question that we need to get a proper expert on this show to answer for you, Henry. And I tell you what, I'll sort it out for you in the next few weeks. Thank you so much for asking it, though. Now, if you've got something sciencey that you want sorted by an expert, the best way to get it answered is to let me know first. Now, you can do that by finding the Fun Kids Science Weekly on the iTunes podcast store. So open that up on your phone or tablet, press a few buttons, and then leave us a review. Now, drop 5 stars, let me know your name, and in that review box, the little square you've got, write the science question that's bugging you. I will see it, and I'll find the right expert to answer it for you. But you need to tell me first. To do that, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly on the iTunes podcast store and leave us a review. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, I want you to do something for me. Try to think of the last time that you forgot something. I don't know, maybe you put down a book and then you completely forgot where it was that you left it. So what did you do? I mean, probably you tried to retrace your steps, right? But you did it in your head to remember where you'd put it down. Well, it turns out it's not just us humans who do this. Dr. Jonathan Crystal from the Indiana University can tell us more. Jonathan, hello.
Hello.
Hello. So, yeah, what I've just said, it's not just us humans, is it? You found out that other creatures are capable of recalling past events.
Right. So we're focused on the problem of how would we ever know what an animal thinks, right? So we're really interested in our animals. We love our animals. But how do we know what they think? So one of the things that we do is we try to use capacities that the animals are really good at. Our animals are rats, and rats are really fantastic with odors. So we present them with odors, and then we assess their memory for all the odors that we gave them. So we have over 100 odors. We might give them a list of all of a random subset. So, for example, we might give them bubblegum, butterscotch, cheddar cheese, cherry, cinnamon, coconut, cotton candy, nutmeg, and then we move them to a different place that we've trained them, that in that place they're supposed to report to us through their behavior what was the second last item in the list, which, if I remember correctly, was cotton candy. And in another context, we move them to yet another place, and we ask them to report again through their behavior what was the fourth last item in the list, and I think that one was cinnamon, and the rats are able to do this.
So you said something very curious to me there. Through their behavior, they were showing you what they had smelled. What behavior were they showing?
Yeah, so this is the real challenge that we, you know, if I wanted to know about your memory, I would ask you and you would answer. And of course, we can't do that with nonverbal animals. So what we do is we confront them with a choice between two of the odors that previously appeared in the list. So they're both ones that are familiar to them, but only one of them is the second last item. The other one we think of as a foil. It's an attractive choice because it was in the list, but it wasn't the second last item. And then we train them to, we infuse these odors on plastic lids of a cup, and we train the animals to kick over the lid, and then they get a little reward in the cup. They get to eat some food. And so the behavior in this case is the animal choosing correctly the odor that matches this location in the list, and avoiding the ones that also appeared in the list, but at the wrong location, at the wrong ordinal location.
And how were you explaining to the rats what smell on the list they needed to identify?
Yeah, so this is the big challenge. Again, I could tell you the rule is 2 and 4, but I can't tell the animals except through their experience. So we give them lots of opportunity to learn. We think they learn from trial and error, that they test out one hypothesis and reject a hypothesis and test out another one. And eventually, all of the animals, every single one, learned the rather arbitrary rules that in one type of context, maybe a big circular arena with closed walls is the place where they're supposed to choose the second last item, and that in a rather smaller arena with a bullseye pattern on the floor that they can see out a little bit better, that that's the place where they should choose the fourth last. And our strategy is to be super patient, to let the animals have lots of opportunity to learn these fairly arbitrary rules.
Now, how did you start this off? So you mentioned at the beginning of this chat that we're always wondering what animals are really thinking. Why did you start assessing how good their memory was and whether they could identify smells? Where did you begin on this journey?
So we're really interested in fundamental questions about cognition in non-human animals. And one of the aspects of cognition in people is referred to as episodic memory. That's our memory for our own personal past experiences. And so we've been trying for a number of years to make the case through experiments like these that the animals, indeed, non-human animals, have episodic memory and that it's not unique to people.
And what else do we know that animals do know? You said that we're wondering, well, what are these animals thinking? Well, what do we know that they are thinking apart from this?
So I'm not sure. We really focus on the memory, and memory has a really good testing ground for asking questions about what animals know, because we give them things that we're choosing and asking them to remember, and then later we can interrogate their knowledge about things that we think they should actually remember. That's a little different than our usual situation interacting with animals out in the natural world, where we don't have quite as much control over the inputs and the expected outputs.
Well, let me quickly just dig a little deeper with this one point. With memory, and we've learned this about what rats can remember very specifically, science is always an ongoing journey. You know, we'll learn from this, and then we'll learn from what's gone before. What have we learned from this, and how are we going to use what we now know about what rats can remember to affect future experiments?
Yeah, so we're really excited about future opportunities that are opened up from this type of work. So this is the first case of a non-human animal replaying its episodic memories. That's our proposal. We think it's like replaying the feed. As you mentioned in your opening example, I've lost something. Where am I going to find it? Well, I might remember what I was doing two or three steps before I last had my car keys or a novel that I'm reading. And I might retrace those steps in the environment based on replaying the feed. So now we think that non-human animals can do that too, which opens up lots of questions. One that we're really interested in is combining the work that we do with regular laboratory rats with genetic models of human diseases. So we work with some rats that have the genes associated with Alzheimer's disease. And one of the most distressing aspects of Alzheimer's disease is a loss of episodic memories. We hope that this will be a testing ground where we can evaluate drugs that might improve episodic memory for Alzheimer's patients down the road.
I'm so happy that that science is being used right now for something that could really be beneficial for everyone's kind of grandparents, you know, in the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years. Very quickly, do you remember what the rat's favorite smell was?
They love chocolate. Probably the most similar thing about us and rats is love for chocolate. They love to eat the chocolate. They love the smell for chocolate. When we give animals chocolate-flavored pellets, there's no amount of chocolate we can give an animal that will stop it from eating more chocolate.
Fantastic. Dr. Jonathan Crystal from the Indiana University, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Thanks very much.
It's time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we talk about the most mean and evil things in the universe. And this time around, it's even more dangerous, because scientists think there's a chance we could actually live there one day. Gliese 581c is a planet 20 light years away from Earth, and it's got some chance that it could support life because there's signs that it holds water. The problem is it's much closer to its largest star than we are to its sun. And it's also tidally locked, So this means it doesn't spin on its axis like our Earth does. You know, we get night and day. They are fixed in one place. And that means one half of the planet is facing the sun and it's boiling hot. It would melt your face off. The other half of it is stone cold. It would freeze you while you stood still. Scientists think, though, that even though it's so dangerous, we could live there one day, and they're trying to make it happen. In 2008, Earth sent a high-powered digital radio signal towards Gliese 581c with loads of messages from us humans back here. It's got to travel 192 trillion kilometres, though. So when it finally gets there, in 2029, I'll let you know what it says. I mean, we will have to wait another 20 years for the aliens to get back to us. But who knows? We might live there one day. I think it'll be too dangerous for us to go to, though. I mean, it does have a place on our Dangerous Dan list, after all. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, we'll talk about plans to clean up some space junk in just a sec. First, let's go there ourselves. To the smartest school outside of the solar system to have a lesson with Professor Pulsar.
Deep Space High, the Universe Handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
It's good to see that your universe handbooks are coming along nicely, so good work, class. Today we'll find out that a rocket on its own isn't enough to take you on your adventures. It needs something else. Any ideas what that might be?
Someone to fly the rocket?
Ah, not necessarily. Computers can pilot rockets and spacecraft without anyone in the driving seat. Most probes are unmanned, in fact. Alex, are you eating?
Sorry, sir. I'm starving, and it's ages till lunchtime. I need something to keep me going.
Well, put it away. You're getting crumbs on your console. What we're studying today is a bit like that packet of crisps, so there's a clue for you. It's something that keeps the rockets going, or gets them off the ground in the first place.
Fuel. You mean rocket fuel?
Exactly. Methods of propulsion, more specifically. Should be a very uplifting lesson. Do you get it? Uplifting. Please yourself. Right, have a look at this bit of film. It's one of Earth's space shuttles launching. Tell me what you can see.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And we have liftoff.
Wow. The space shuttle looks pretty small on the back of those enormous rockets. There's masses of smoke and loads of fire from the fuel being burnt to propel it into orbit.
That's right. In order to break out of Earth's orbit, enormous rocket boosters were needed. They burned an astronomical 800,000 gallons of fuel just to get it into orbit. And even when it was up in space, the shuttle needed to carry huge amounts of hydrazine and oxygen to power it about.
And the shuttle didn't even go very far.
Hey, it did pretty well.
Anyway, that gives you an idea of the sort of power rockets are packing. And they have to carry fuel with them because...
Well, there aren't exactly petrol stations in space, are there?
Sadly not. And that means rockets on long journeys have to carry all the fuel they will need. Alex, it would be like your dad's car having a fuel tanker on the roof rack. That'd slow him down, wouldn't it? Having to carry fuel is the biggest obstacle stopping people from travelling further into space. Luckily, there are some very cool ways of propelling craft that might just give everyone a boost. A boost? Did you get it?
Do you think he's got many more of those jokes?
I don't know, but he should definitely stick to teaching.
Buckle up. We're going to look at a solar sail. And guess what, Alex? It's in your solar system.
Wow, that must be it. It's a glittering thin square with something shiny. It's spinning gently, but I don't see any fuel tanks.
This is Icarus, one of the first solar sails. It was sent into space by the Japanese Space Agency in 2010 and uses the power of the sun to propel itself. Here's how it works. Sunlight travels in minuscule packets called photons. And when a photon reflects off a mirrored surface, like the sail, it makes two minuscule taps. One when it hits, and one when it's reflected. And those tiny taps are what provide the power.
It doesn't sound like it gets much speed up that way.
But due to a clever bit of physics called constant acceleration, it starts slowly but gets faster and faster. from a few millimetres a second to hundreds and thousands of miles per hour, and all without a drop of fuel. Another method of propulsion is ion engines. There's one a bit close to Earth. Here we are high in Earth's orbit, and this is GOCE, an Earth observation satellite. It uses ion engines to propel itself about.
Ion engines? Like irons that make clothes nice and smooth? Where does it keep the ironing board?
Not that sort of iron, silly. I-O-N. I-O-N. Go on, Stats, I can see you're itching to tell us more.
We have tons of these on my planet. Ions are atoms with an electrical charge. An ion engine uses strong magnets to shove the ions out the back at massive speed. And as the ions go back, the engine is propelled forwards.
But where do the ions come from?
They can be created pretty easily, or sort of scooped up from the universe.
Now, solar sails and ion engines certainly haven't solved all the problems. But they do at least show that there are ways of harnessing the power of the universe. In time, this means space travellers will be able to go further than ever before. And on the subject of fuel, you'll be pleased to hear it's lunchtime. Or should that be launch time? Class dismissed.
Deep Space High, the Universe Handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
Right, let's talk about all the science that has been in the news this week. An ape that is completely new to science has been discovered buried in an ancient tomb in China. Now, the bad news is the gibbon is already extinct. Scientists think that this is from 2,300 years ago, and it's been named Junji Imperialis, and it was thought to have been made extinct by hunting and the loss of its home. Also, the UK-led project to tackle space junk has been launched from the International Space Station. The Remove Debris satellite was thrown into the black by a robotic arm. It's got a net and a harpoon, and it'll grab some space junk that's been left over by dismantled rockets to demonstrate how this can be done and we can be cleaner in the future. And finally, work has begun to upgrade the Large Hadron Collider particle smasher at CERN, and it's being updated to a high luminosity LHC, and this will make it even better and more clearer for us to study the fundamental building blocks of matter, and we can see it in more detail than ever before. It's time for another Man vs. Beast challenge.
Extreme athlete challenge with the Society of Biology.
You join us just as the race is about to begin. We're pitting man against animal in our extreme athlete challenge. So who's travelled the furthest on Earth? Our first competitor is our human, Jessica Stender, world record holder for the greatest distance walked in 24 hours. And up against him, it's the Arctic Tern.
A tough little bird that follows summer around the globe. She's small, but don't let that fool you.
They're taking their places. And they're off.
Jessica Stender has set off on a steady pace. In 1976, he walked over 228 kilometres in just one day and night.
That's a staggering road trip to make.
But the Arctic Tern is certainly fast off the mark. In the space of a year, she'll travel 35,000 kilometres.
Now that's 100 kilometres a day, which is less than Jessie managed. But remember, this bird is covering that distance on average every single day of the year. There's no contest. Combining endurance with distance, our Arctic Tern is clearly the winner, our Extreme Athlete of the Day.
Well done.
Extreme Athlete Challenge with the Society of Biology.
That is it for this episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly then. We're back soon with another trip to the deepest, most dark and dangerous places in the whole universe. Make sure that you're listening and that you're ready for takeoff when it comes around. I want to see you there. Now, in the meantime, if you've got a science question that you really want answered, you need to make sure you let me know first. The best way is to drop it in the review box on the iTunes podcast store. So open it up Find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, write the question for me, and I will make sure I'll find an expert to answer it for you. Oh, while you're on iTunes, by the way, that is one of the best places that you can catch up with all our brilliant Fun Kids Science series, like some of the things you've heard so far in this episode. You can get it there. You can also get it on the free Fun Kids app, and they're all there for you at funkidslive.com. And you can listen to Fun Kids all over the country on your DAB digital radio on that free Fun Kids app. And as always, find us at funkidslive.com. Now, very quickly, before I go, I wanted to share with you this thing I've just found. I really like it. It's perfect if you're like me and you love the World Cup. It's the Match of the Day podcast. Now, I'm going to play you a little sneak peek. And if you like it, remember, you can download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from.
Welcome to Match of the Day magazine's World Cup show with me, Paz, and him, Ketch.
Hello, this is the World Cup show which will 100% not crash out in the group stage.
This show is not going to get referred to VAR.
It's the only show you need to keep you up to date with everything you need to know about Russia 2018. So some of the things we're going to be discussing is the reaction to England's first game. I'm going to pretend to be Gareth Southgate. We're going to talk about the top five players to look out for at Russia. I'm going to teach you some Russian, Paz, and we're also going to give you some playground ammo stats to impress your mates.
So come on then, ref, let's get this show kicked off.
So, England got their World Cup campaign off to a dramatic start with a last-gasp 2-1 win over Tunisia. Harry Kane scoring both goals, including an injury-time winner. Nice one, Harry.
They certainly left it late, didn't they? Come on then, Ketch. Can you describe England's performance in one word?
Trousers.
Trousers?
Yeah, trousers. Not exactly exciting, but they got the job done.
I see.
What did we learn then, Paz?
Well, if you ever go to Volgograd on holiday, take a gigantic tub of insect repellent with you, because those local flies were swarming around England players, like the England players were swarming all over the Tunisians in the first 10 minutes.
Anything about the football rather than the local wildlife?
Well, I think England's three behind Harry Kane proved they can cause problems for anyone. That first 10-15 minutes, the way they were just interchanging and rotating and floating around, we're talking Raheem Sterling, Dele Alli and Jesse Lingard, they caused all sorts of problems. Harry Kane proved he's a world-class striker who will pop up with the goods when you need him to. And also we learned we got game changers on the bench as well in Marcus Rashford and Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who both made a massive impact when they came on and helped us get the 3 points. So come on, Ketch, who was your star of the show? Who was your man of the match?
Well, it's got to be Harry Kane, hasn't it? Our captain, our leader, the man who will score most of our goals in Russia. He had two half chances and he buried them. It was a massively important win for us. It's coming home, Paz.
Now it's time for Ketch. It's Gareth Southgate. He's got his official England Marks and Spencer's waistcoat on, his beard is neatly trimmed, and we've all agreed that no one is going to mention that penalty from Euro 96. So, Ketch, I'm going to give you some big dilemmas that are facing Gareth Southgate right now. You're in his shoes, you've got some big calls to make. Are you ready?
Let's do it, Paz.
Okay, first up is number one, Ashley Young or Danny Rose?
You know what? I think we need to change it up a bit and go with Danny Rose. A little birdie called Paz told me that there was no left-footers in our first game starting 11, so let's get a natural left-footer in there. Danny Rose is perfect. He hasn't played a lot of football, but I think that makes him fresher. So let's get him in at left wing back, see what he can do.
Number two, Eric Dier or Jordan Henderson?
Now, I like Eric Dier, but Jordan Henderson, he didn't do anything wrong. He made all of his tackles, 6 out of 6. He won all of his aerial balls. He only gave the ball away once. He hasn't done anything wrong. He's had a fantastic season with Liverpool. Keep him in there. He can do a job for us.
That's big praise indeed, coming from a Newcastle fan to a Sunderland native.
Keep that quiet.
Keep that quiet, okay. Number three, Raheem Sterling or Marcus Rashford?
Now, this is a tricky one. I think if you ask Raheem himself, he would admit he didn't have the best game against Tunisia. But I think he deserves another chance. Let's keep Rashford on ice. He can make a big impact for us deeper into the tournament.
And finally, Ruben Loftus-Cheek. Can you squeeze him into your starting 11?
I would love for him to squeeze into our starting 11. He's strong, he's quick, he's creative, and the most important thing, he's fearless. So if there's space for him in the team, I'd love to see him get a run out later on.
But you've got to make that space. Who makes way for Ruben Loftus-Cheek?
You know what? Maybe Dele Alli. Little thigh strain. Yeah, let's do it, Ruben. Get yourself in there, son. Now it's a part of the show we like to call the top five players of the 2018 World Cup so far, where we reveal our, wait for it, top five players of the 2018 World Cup so far.
Yeah, catchy, catch, catchy.
There's been some decent displays so far. Just missing out on a place in our illustrious top five are Diego Godin, Uruguay defender, Isco, Spain, Denis Kirishev, the Russian, Philip Coutinho of Brazil, Sergei Milinkov-Savic, and Hannes Thor Halldórsson.
It's easy for you to say. Now, we need some music, DJ. Can we get some countdown music, please?
Five.
At five, it's Irving Lozano, the Mexican magician, counter-attacking wizard, and the man who frazzled the Germans as Mexico beat the holders 1-0.
Four.
At four, it's big Romelu Lukaku. He's only 25, but he's got 70 caps for Belgium. He's their record scorer with 38 goals, and he scored twice against Panama in the opener.
Three.
At number three, it's Mr. Grizzly himself, Diego Costa of Spain. Two goals for him in Spain's first game against Portugal.
Two.
At two, arise Sir Harry Kane, England's saviour against Tunisia. Two goals, including an injury time winner. What a way to make a World Cup debut.
One.
But this week's number one is no drum roll needed. It's obviously Cristiano Ronaldo. Who else could it possibly be? A hat-trick against Spain, a late free kick equaliser. This man never fails to deliver.
So that hat-trick, Ketch, took Ronaldo to six World Cup goals. He's overtaken Messi now in World Cup goals, who's got five. The next target for Ron is Portugal's record World Cup goal scorer, Eusebio. Eusebio's a legend in Portugal. He got nine World Cup goals in total. Can Ronaldo do it?
There aren't many things Ronaldo hasn't done, but interestingly, he's never won the Golden Boot at a major international tournament. Is this his year?
Now, surprisingly, it took 48 hours, but eventually the debate turned to Messi versus Ronaldo. It's the age-old question, who is the best? Now, I'd kind of accepted that Messi was the GOAT. Messi was the greatest of all time, but Ronaldo is not making life easy for me. He's doing pretty much everything he can to make me question whether Messi is the GOAT or not. Ronaldo haters will say it was only a penalty, it was a mistake by David De Gea, and it was a free kick. But Messi had opportunities as well. He missed a penalty, he had a free kick at the end, which he didn't convert. But I would say that still, I'm leaning towards Messi being the best of all time. He's just got that little bit more stardust for me.
Do you know what? I used to be Team Messi, a pure natural talent, an inspiration to vertically challenge footballers all over the world. But watching what Ronaldo did to Spain at the weekend, right now, he is the GOAT. No question. He won that pen. He scored the pen. He forced a world-class keeper into a mistake. And then the free kick. My word. The build-up. The 88th minute. The deep breaths. The stance. The connection he made with the ball. But what I love the most, sometimes a defensive wall doesn't do its job. But Busquets on the end of that wall. This is a 6'2" midfielder. He's leapt as high as he can. He's straining to get his head in the way and deflect that ball, but he can't. It's perfect connection. De Gea couldn't have stopped it, even if he had access to a stepladder.
Wow. Only asked you a simple question, mate.
I love Ronaldo, what can I say?
You know, it's time for another top five. This is Paz and Ketch's top five things in the air.
In at number five, it's a bumblebee, a chubby little black and yellow flying insect that eats flowers and makes a buzzing noise.
At four, it's an albatross. It's very big, it's got very big wings, and it can fly for ages over the oceans.
In at number three, it's a helicopter, a type of aircraft with spinny blades on its head.
At two, it's a jumbo jet, my favourite type of aeroplane because it normally takes me on my holidays.
And in at number one of Paz and Ketch's top five things in the air, it's Harry Maguire, largest head in World Cup history, and a good job too. His flick-on set up Harry Kane's winner against Tunisia. England would be in trouble without Maguire's superb bonds.
God bless Harry Maguire's head.
Okay, Paz, seeing as the World Cup is in Russia this year, I thought I'd teach you a bit of Russian. What do you think?
Oh, that's fine, mate. Yeah, I was great at French at school.
Okay, so repeat after me. Moyo glova pohoza na yitsu.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Break that down for me.
Moyo glova.
Moyo glova.
Pohoza.
Pohoza.
Na yitsu.
Na yitsu.
Moyo glova pohoza na yitsu.
Moyo glova mohoya. Moyo glova pohoya na yitsu.
Moyo glova pohoza na yitsu.
Okay, I get the idea. So that's what, where's the local train station? Where's the shop? Where's the local football pitch?
No, that's a phrase especially tailored for you, Paz. It means my head is like an egg. Could come in handy.
Yeah, what's wishing for go away, please, mate?
Time for some playground ammo to impress your mates and prove you are the ultimate World Cup expert.
Okay, first up, did you know there are more Manchester City players at this World Cup than any other team?
Sergio Ramos has got Amor Paz tattooed on his arm. Amor means love in Spanish. So does that mean Sergio Ramos loves you, Paz?
I hope so. That would be lovely. Yeah. Did you know there are three sets of brothers at this World Cup? There are the Hazards with Belgium, the Dos Santoses with Mexico, and the Maranchuk twins from Russia.
The heaviest player at the tournament is Panama's Roman Torres. Keep an eye out for him against England. He'll be trying to mark Harry Kane.
Ooh, and talking of England, that goal by Harry Kane in the last minute was the first time England have scored a 90th minute winner in a World Cup match ever.
So, Paz, seeing as we work for Match of the Day magazine, I thought it would be a good idea to run through what is in our very special issue this week.
That is a very good idea indeed. So, first up, we've got a free giant double-sided poster. It's Ronaldo on one side and a whole host of illustrated World Cup stars on the other.
And in that same issue, I went inside the England camp. I spoke to Danny Welbeck. He told me what life is like for an England player at a World Cup camp. I spoke to Ashley Young. He told me about England's secret warm-up that involves a rubber chicken. And I also spoke to goalkeeper Nick Pope, and he told me, yes, England are practicing penalties.
Wow, I need to read that feature. We also reveal the 50 World Cup ballers you need to watch.
We also spoke to BBC star Gabby Logan. She told us how to be a TV presenter.
And we rank and rate all 32 World Cup kits this summer.
Japan for me.
Nigeria number one.
Spoiler alert.
Well, Ketch, that's it for the first Match of the Day magazine World Cup show.
A bit like England's performance, it started well, tailed off a bit in the middle, but I think we clawed our way back into it in the end.
There's no easy shows, mate. No time for complacency. Focus, work hard, train hard, and you've just got to record what's in front of you.
That doesn't make any sense. Anyway, enough chat. As they say in Russia, proshay for now.
Proshay? What's that?
Goodbye.
Oh, goodbye.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB Digital Radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.